I am not only a woman, I am a short person. And sometimes I think a short person has to do more than tall people. A very good friend of mine is the campus legal counsel, and he is also not a tall person. And we find lots of times that, you know, we really have to, you know, walk with purposeful walk, we always call it, and really have confidence in ourselves.
This is Joe Longo, and you're listening to the Orange, a long-form interview podcast with University of Illinois alums about their time on campus and how they got to where they are now. Today we have on Robin Kaler, who holds the distinguished title of being the Associate Chancellor for Public Affairs at the university. But that's just one of many hats that Kaler wears on campus. She's a 1983 grad with degrees in journalism and business administration, as well as a native of Rantoul, Illinois, just a few miles north of Champaign. And she's also a proud mom to two university students, including one alum and one current senior. I've known Kaler since my first days on campus. As a reporter for the Daily Illini, I routinely communicate with her on all university matters, especially when someone at the university doesn't want to speak and she becomes their spokesperson. But as she makes clear in our conversation, it's always friendly, and I have to agree. So, without further ado, here's my talk with Robin Kaler.
To start off with, I guess we'll start with that. So you worked at WPGU. How soon within your career as a student did you get involved there?
So I started, I believe, when I was a sophomore, end of my sophomore year, the summer before junior year. I had met someone in a class. I didn't even know there was a WPGU, and I met someone in a class who said they worked at this radio station. It sounded really cool. And so I went in, and of course, back then, everybody could work at DBS, the Dormitory Broadcasting System, which I take
They're
it does not still exist,
no,
right?
No, it does not.
So it was a it was actually a closed-circuit system that only went to the dorms.
Oh, okay.
So the only way anyone would listen to you was if you told
if
your friend, I'm going to be on at X time, turn on your radio to whatever dial position it was, and so you might have one listener or two. So it was kind of a practice by yourself, try to figure out how to do radio thing.
So you didn't want to do that. You wanted to do WPGU, which a step up?
Oh, yeah, but you have to start at DBS, or you did back then. So you did your little time in the little booth talking to nobody. And then eventually either somebody graduated or left, or they thought you sounded good enough and they let you, you know, go on air. So,
So WPGU was in Weston, the dorm at the time. What year was that?
I was there, it would have been, I started college in 79, so probably 80, 81 to 83, something like that. Yeah.
And what dorm, did you live in a dorm your freshman year?
I did not. I was first generation to attend college, and I'm from the area, and I lived at home with my parents. I couldn't afford to live on campus. So for me, PGU really became my fraternity, sorority, you know, my home, everything. There was a beat-up old sofa that a lot of us would sleep on a lot of the time. So that was really my, that was my home away from home.
And you're from you were from Rantoul?
Correct, yeah.
And so did you consider, being from Rantoul, is that within the townie boundaries?
Totally. Yeah, I was totally a townie. So in high school, we would come and hang out where Coco Mero is now, was a Garcia's Pizza.
Right. My mom talks about that.
And now I'm gonna, and I'm really going to make myself sound old. First time I went to that Garcia's, you get a slice of cheese and an orange soda for 50 cents. And yeah, it was awesome. And the first time I went there was after my first concert, which was Karen and Richard Carpenter, the Carpenters.
The Carpenters
At Assembly Hall. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That would be a cool concert to go to.
Yeah, that was fun. But that was my start in rock and roll. Yeah. And I worked up to Springsteen, but it took a while. Yeah.
So you commuted your freshman year or all 4 years?
All 4 years. My father, you know, again, my parents couldn't afford to have me live on campus, but my father was a mechanic and he found a car at the dump that he repurposed. It had a blown engine, and it had been an automatic, and he put a standard engine in it, so where the stick shift was, you could see the ground, because the car, he had to cut a hole in the car to put it in there. So the whole way to college, I could see the ground every time I shifted gears. But it was a great car, a little red Datsun, and I named it Wild Cherry, and I would drive all my friends around in it around campus, so... Yeah, very fun.
It'd be cool to be that freshman that has a... I'd be envious. I'm still envious of that. I don't have a car yet, and I'm a junior.
Yeah, it was handy, and everybody wanted to ride. It was, you know, to me, it was no big deal because I lived here, and but I gave a lot of people a lot of rides. And it's funny, you know where everything is when you're a townie, and so that's a helpful thing, too. And my daughters both have attended Illinois, and my younger daughter, freshman year, she lived in Weston, and her friends all called her TG, which was short for tour guide, or GPS,
because she
knew where everything was. Yeah.
Was it hard to be a freshman that wasn't on campus?
You know, at the time, I didn't realize that it was. But for example, I would drive around the quad, and if I couldn't find a parking place in three trips around the quad, I would just go home and just skip classes that day, which is not a great thing to do. And then I really didn't make a lot of friends because, you know, you don't really make your buddies in class. You make your friends in the dorms. But I didn't realize I wasn't making friends. And my husband now, he was not my husband at the time, he encouraged me to join a sorority, and I did that. And it was fine, and they were lovely people, but it really wasn't my thing. And then a friend, I should say a classmate, said something about PGU, and I went there, and then I was home. I found home. And my, you know, dearest friend from college was a fellow PGUer. Yeah.
So did you go through Rush your freshman year?
Sophomore year, yeah. So I did everything weird. Yeah. Everything I did was wonky because, you know, when your parents didn't go to college and you don't have any role model for what you're supposed to do, you just kind of wander around. And these days, as an employee of the university, I'm so proud of the programs we have to help first-generation students because I know exactly what it felt like to just kind of wander aimlessly and make really bad decisions, not because you're not smart, but because you don't really have good information, and we're a lot better at sharing that information with students now. But
that reminds me of my mom's story because she came in the 80s to the university, and she said she came from the suburbs without having ever visited the campus.
Wow,
which
not
today
at all.
I can't imagine coming down not having walked around or anything.
Yeah.
And she rushed her sophomore year. She lived in dorms in Urbana, and it wasn't right. And then she rushed her sophomore year too. So that
kind of found her place.
Place.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm sure we had gone on the quad some, but we really campus town was where townies hung out. You know, you didn't really want to hang out in classrooms or anything, but you'd hang out, you know, outside of the bars, in the bars when you could get in the bars, and then, you know, in the restaurants. And there were lots of shops back then. There was a sporting goods shop, a running shoe shop, you know, those kind of things. And so I'd get my hair cut on campus because that's where the cool hairstylists were, where you get the hipster haircuts, or, you know, what passed for hipster in 1979. Yeah.
And I want to go back to, you mentioned you were a first generation student. That itself is a experience to have.
Yeah, it is. And my father ran away from home, not because he didn't like his parents or anything, but he wanted to travel, and he ran away from home when he was 16 to join the military. And then he joined the military. He's 6 years older than my mom, and he traveled the world a little bit, came back to his hometown. They're from the Cumberland Gap area of Virginia, Tennessee. And she was 16 or 17 when they got married. They eloped and snuck away. And, yeah, so my mom hadn't even finished high school. My dad ended up finishing an associate's degree and then ended up teaching at Parkland College in town. But my mom finally got her GED when I was maybe in high school or something. So really the whole idea of school was not it wasn't really anything that they had experience with at a high level. They appreciated it, but they didn't say, oh, you must go to college. My older sister and I both went to college. My older brother and my younger sister did not. So, you know, back then it was just different, and especially if you didn't come from a family that had a tradition of attending college.
Did you, when you were a student, was that a pressure? Did you, feel like you had to prove anything?
Not at all, actually. It seemed to me more like a continuation of high school. That just, I'm taking more classes, but nobody's making me go to class, so I may not go as often as I used to, and I'm paying for it. But I was a good student in high school, and I got a lot of scholarships. In fact, I made money my freshman year, and I went and spent it all on clothes because I thought, hey, this is a great arbitrage I got going here. They're paying me to do this. And then I didn't realize that you had to apply for scholarships again, that they were only for 1 year. And so the second year, I got this bill in the mail, you know, the first week of school or something, and I went into it was called the bursar's office back then, you know, the financial aid office, and I said, hey, I got this thing, I don't understand what it is, and they said, well, that's your bill for school, and I said, well, no, last year they gave me money, and they said, well, did you get scholarships last year, and I said, yeah, and they said, well, did you apply for them again, and I said, no, and so then I had to scramble, although back then, you know, school was much less expensive than it is now. But then I put myself through, if you will, you know, working jobs and things. But my parents obviously supported me. I lived at home. They made all my meals. They, you know, helped me with clothing. They paid for my car and gasoline and that sort of thing. So I had a lot of help, but I paid the tuition myself.
Yeah, you had to navigate it by yourself.
I did, yeah, yeah.
That's an interesting experience. I couldn't imagine. I come with my mom coming here, but also I come from one of those very, I guess, I don't know. I think it's one of those, I don't want to call it helicopter families, but one of those where it's just my parents know what they're.
We're all helicopter families now. That, I mean, I do the same thing to my kids. It is a generational thing. You know, I think as the world, you know, appears to get bigger and you see more through social media and 24/7 news and that sort of thing, it seems more dangerous. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I think for those of us who maybe had a little higher standard of living than our own parents did, you just want to give your kids things. You want to make sure they didn't have to struggle in any ways that you might have had to struggle or even felt like you were struggling. So there is that tendency to try to guide them. I find, you know, especially being a parent of students here, I've seen enough helicopter parents that I have to really stop myself and say, ooh, I'm being one of them. Cut it out. And sometimes my daughters would say, you know, can you do blah, blah? And I'd say, well, I can give you the phone number. And why don't you make that call? And so they're pretty independent themselves now.
And so you have two daughters. They both graduated?
That one graduated a year ago, and she's now doing grad school here in the high school. And then one's a senior. So, yeah.
And how is it going from being the first generation student at U of I to being the mother of U of I students while also working at the university?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really interesting. It makes you so proud to have your children go where you went. My kids have never gone to a school I attended. And I attended a lot of schools. My father was in the Air Force. We lived all over the nation. But so it's kind of fun to have them be at a place I was and have traditions that I had and that sort of thing. Probably the hardest part for me is in my job. You know, I'm the spokesman for the university, and so I handle a lot of crisis communications. So I always get the call in the night when there's been a this or a that or whatever. And, you know, of course, you always worry about, you know, is somebody hurt and whatever. But when you're a parent, you think, ah, it's my kid. You know, when there was a shooting, what was that, a year ago in the fall,
yeah.
It was, you know, they said it was at the corner of 4th and Green. And when the police chief called me, I said, you know, Jeff, is anybody killed? Is anybody injured? And he said, yeah, there's a fatality. And I said, you know, who is it? And he said, we don't know yet. And I said, my daughter lives at 309 Green. It's right there at that corner. And, you know, and it was just horrifying. And there's nothing you can do. And so, of course, I'm like every other parent. I start calling her, and she doesn't answer. And it turned out she was sound asleep. And, it wasn't until enough of her friends had texted her, because they had heard about it, too, that that she finally called me and said, what? It's okay. I'm fine.
I remember getting those calls. And I was the weekend of Pygmalion, so I remember I was down in downtown Champaign, mm-hmm. and my mom, even it was like late at night, she called me.
Yeah.
She's like, I got these emails.
Are you okay?
And she's like, are you okay?
Yeah.
How do you, and that's an interesting story, because you had to both put on your hat as a mom and as the university spokesman. How do you balance that line?
Yeah, that's hard. But you have to do your job. You have to do your job. But people are very understanding when you have a child here and something might be going on. They're not going to make you not do it. But the police chief has a child here as well. You know, most of us either have children who have attended college or are attending college or about to attend college. So everybody kind of gets that part of it. And we all just try to be supportive of each other. So there's a lot of that going on. But yeah, but it's hard. And you really have to make sure you make decisions based on not that's my baby, but that's anybody's baby. And that should be the same decision, really, because we should think of every student here as our own child, even though we don't parent them. But we should care about them like they're our own children.
So they've worked, both of those hats kind of work together.
They really should. They really should. And yeah, it's just your heart beats a little faster when your own child might be involved in it. You know, I remember our older daughter cheered here for a couple of years, and the big Indiana game. Remember when we beat Indiana and everybody stormed the court? And my husband and I are sitting in our seats, and we can see our daughter, and she's very tiny, and we can see her on the floor. And when, you know, Griffey sings the shot, you know, the crowd just goes crazy, and she's gone, and we can't see her. And we're both saying, she's going to get mauled. She's just this little tiny thing. And, you know, by the time we could get down to the floor to see her, she'd kind of worked her way back out to the side, and she was just, you know, she was sweating, her hair was all gone, and she said, this is awesome. We thought, okay, stop worrying. Phew, she's all right. Yeah, but, you know, you just, even in happy things, you just worry. So, yeah. But that my job is to worry, I guess, about everybody here. That's kind of what I'm supposed to do.
And on that, you mentioned you deal with a lot of crises that happen on campus. I imagine with that comes a decent amount of criticism. You have to have a tough skin for that.
You do. And, I spent 10 years as a journalist before I came to the university. And so you get used to what that is like. Because, when you write a story and somebody doesn't think it's right, they fuss at you a lot. So, and you're in a very public role there. So I had 10 years of getting used to having people fuss about things. What you kind of learn is sometimes if you get fussing from the left and the right, you feel like, okay, maybe I split the difference pretty well. And you just try to always keep the core values of the institution at heart. People will call me and they'll say, we have this thing where somebody wants to do something with the chief and should we allow them to or not? And I always say, take the chief out and put puppies and kittens in there. And if you would say yes, say yes. And if you would say no, say no. You can't base it on content. And so we always have to just say, what are our core values? And if our core value is free speech, for example, then we have to honor free speech.
So. Well, and I mean, and that example is something we, if you don't mind going into it, that was an issue at homecoming.
Yes, it was.
How did you have to manage that?
So I staffed the chancellor, obviously, and his car had been stopped by protesters, and then the police. He's a very, strong guy. He was not intimidated by protesters or anything, but the police. The head of the police, who was the head of the detail that night, had said, we need to make a decision about what to do because, we're at this log jam. So I had to go and get him and his wife out of the car they were in and then take them over to the police command center, and we were trying to make a decision on what to do. And as we were discussing the options, we looked up, and the band was marching off towards Alma Mater, and the protesters were following them. And by the time we could even get out of the command car, the parade had resumed itself, so that kind of resolved itself, and we were able to walk the chancellor. He didn't finish the last couple blocks of the parade, but we walked him over to the pep rally, and then we went back to the parade. And by then, the person dressed as the chief had come to a stop with the protesters, and the police had escorted him away. And then again, the parade finished out. So it was kind of surreal. But, that's what happens at universities, right? You get a lot of people on different sides of issues learning how to express themselves and learning how to make their case. And sometimes they make good decisions and sometimes they don't make good decisions. And sometimes they learn from them and sometimes they don't. But, the whole point of being here is to learn how to think critically, analytically, and really then become a leader. And you can't do that without feeling passionately about something and trying to make it happen.
Again, if you don't mind me asking, we talked today a lot about the importance of adding women in powerful roles, and you're a woman in a powerful role. Do you find I think of the emails that I get from you as a student, but then also at the DI, we work with you a lot, sometimes much more friendly than other times.
Aww. Oh, it's always but, friendly. Yeah. You guys are great. Yeah.
Do you find as a woman that it's, you have to, take on a different angle?
Well, I think you have to. I am not only a woman, I am a short person. And sometimes I think a short person has to do more than tall people. A very good friend of mine is the campus legal counsel, and he is also not a tall person. And we find lots of times that, we really have to, walk with purposeful walk, we always call it, and really have confidence in ourselves, because I think other people do tend to, if you look a little youthful and you're smaller, and then certainly if you're female, I think people tend to think of you as not necessarily being as seasoned or as smart or whatever as somebody else. So yeah, I think having confidence, making sure that you've done your research really well and that you know what you're talking about, and then listening to other people, that's still a hard one for me, but I try to really listen and see what other people have to say, and then I offer the chancellor my best advice, and he's hearing from his entire cabinet, and then it's his job to sort out everything we've said and go from there. So and sometimes, you know, he does the thing that I recommended, and sometimes he does the thing somebody else recommended. But he's a pretty smart guy, and I'd go with what he says over what I say. So.
And then I want to go back to, as you briefly mentioned, you are from Rantoul when you came to the university,
yeah.
But that's not where you grew up.
Well, I did grow up there, but it's not the only place I lived. So I was born in North Carolina. My family had lived in Kansas, Tennessee, Colorado, Kansas again before I was born. But yeah, so I was born in North Carolina. We moved to Texas, Mississippi, North Dakota, and then Illinois. And then I grew up and I went to high school in Illinois. So yeah.
You know, is there a moment within, you know, moving around that you felt like, you know, you've been in, how many years have you now been in Champaign? Or with
we moved here when I was in second grade. So this is home.
This is home.
For me. Yeah, I was 1968. I think I was 7 or 8 years old. I was in, yeah, second grade. So this is where I consider home. It's kind of funny, though, because my town was, you know, it was a military town, but then it was also a farming community. And so kids would always say, oh, you're base kid, basically meaning you're not from here. Not in a mean way, but I never really felt like I was of the community when I was a kid because they always say, oh, you're base kid. But now I've been there so long that I'm a townie. So.
Was there a moment that you remember which you felt like Champaign, Rantoul, Central Illinois was your home?
Oh, sure. When we would go back to visit my grandparents in Virginia, and they would say, you know, y'all talk funny. I'd say, no, you talk funny, yeah. And then, you know, realizing, okay, that is definitely not where I'm from. You know, it's like all the kids we have, the DACA undocumented kids, this idea that you would send a child to a country where, yeah, maybe they're from there. They've got maybe relatives, maybe not, but somehow that, you know, DNA-wise, they're from there. But that is not their home. And to send them there, especially kids who don't even speak the language. I mean, I have enough trouble understanding my relatives who have Southern accents. So I, you know, I get that feeling that, you know, no, this is my home. And you know, why would you want to go somewhere else? So, no, I feel I'm definitely from here. And again, I feel for the kids we have who are, you know, feeling threatened, like they may be told, no, you're not from here and you don't belong here. Because it's one thing to say, oh, I don't think you're from here. That's fine. And it's all good. But to say you don't belong here just really cheeses me off. I'll say it that way.
Yeah. And you've stayed. You know, you went to school here. You've worked.
I did. Did not intend to. Had no intention of that. So when I was in school and I worked at PGU, I always assumed I would eventually end up in New York City. And I, at the time, the guy who was in the big chair at CBS was Dan Rather, and now I was gunning for him. That was where I was going to go. And but I had met my husband, and you know, ended up getting married and sort of had a life here. And we always said, you know, if somebody got a job offer or saw a job they liked that was somewhere else that paid what we both made, we would leave. And you know, a couple times we had possibilities, but nothing was ever attractive enough to make us go. And then we had a child, and then it's really hard to leave where your parents are because make them really sad. And then they also provide great child care. So then you kind of get anchored in a community once you have children. And this is a great place to raise kids. So I'm totally happy we stayed.
Has it, you know, did you ever consider when you do look back that like, oh, I wish I would have?
You know, I don't. I don't even think about it anymore. It's funny. When I first got out of journalism, within a couple of months, there was the OJ trial, and there was a tornado in a community, St. Joseph, around here. And I remember, you know, a couple of times thinking, oh, man, I don't know what's going on anymore. And, you know, when you're in the news, you know, you get to hear all kinds of stuff. But by then, I'd started working at the university, and I'd begun to work my way into what I do now, where, again, you get to kind of see how the sausage is made. So my Jones for journalism was you know, taken care of through my current job. So, yeah, not really. I'll never forget the first election night after I got out of the business. I was in bed. My husband and I were in bed in our jammies watching the 10 o'clock news. And somebody, you know, the anchor came on TV and said, oh, you know, something was broken at with the, you know, the polling place or something. And it was going to take them a really long time to count the votes that night. And my first thought was, damn it, I'm going to be up all night. And I thought, no, wait a minute. That's not me anymore. I can go to bed. I can sleep 8 hours. And when I wake up, somebody will have won. I don't care.
You don't have to worry about it anymore.
And it was great. It was very liberating. So, yeah.
And so to give a little background, you were the you worked at DWS.
Yeah. Yeah, I was there for 10 years out of school. I started off as a afternoon anchor. I covered the Urbana City Council. Eventually worked up to being the news director and doing morning drive. So, yeah. Was there for a long time.
And then so you did that, and then you took off a few years to...
I didn't take off. I when I had my daughter, you know, it's really hard to have a baby and nurse a baby and do morning drive radio and run a news department. And so I think I complained about it on the air. And somebody at the university said, hey, the chancellor's looking for a speech writer. You ought to apply for that. And so I applied for it, and I was fortunate enough to get an offer. And I said, well, you know, I feel a little weird. I've never done speech writing. So, you know, it worries me that the chancellor might not like my writing style. I might not be able to figure out his speaking style. Could you tell me what his next speech is going to be? And I'll take a stab at writing it. I'll turn it in. You have him look at it and make sure he's comfortable with me. And they said, okay, no problem. So it was the Martin Luther King annual observance.
Who was the chancellor at the time?
His name was Michael Aiken. Yeah, he was my first chancellor, and I'm on my seventh now. Yeah. And so I wrote this, what I would do if I were working for Michael, and I submitted it. And they called me back and said, yeah, do you want the job? And I said, well, how, you know, did he like what I wrote? And they said, yeah, it was great. He thought it was great. So I took the job. And the first time I went in to meet with him, I said, you know, I was nervous and everything. I said, well, I'm so relieved that you liked my writing and whatever. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, you know, that speech I wrote, you know, for Martin Luther King, you know, so you could see what I would do. And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. So they'd never shown it to him. So then, of course, my confidence was in the toilet, but very quickly developed a rapport with him and really loved it. And really, speech writing is the same as writing for radio. You know, writing for the year is writing for the year. So it became kind of fun. And then basically what happened was I was halftime there. I also took a job running the Chamber of Commerce in my town because I kind of panicked about taking a pay cut. And so I ran the Chamber of Commerce in my town and was this halftime speech writer. So I had basically a full-time job. Did that for a few years. But at the university, things would come up where they'd need somebody to help them with crisis management or with, you know, making commercials or something, things that were in my wheelhouse. And I would do those things. And so my portfolio kind of grew. And so I quit the chamber and ended up being full-time at the university. And I've been here ever since. So And I taught at the university before I worked for the chancellor. When I was still in radio, I would teach one class. And so I'd already had, you know, some experience here and just kind of morphed into all university. And so for, I don't know, it was maybe 13 or 14 years, I taught and worked for the chancellor. And then when I got the job I have now, I had to quit teaching. So
it's interesting because as a student, so much of, and I imagine this was probably the case for you, so much of it, and especially in journalism, it's so planned. Like, you know what your steps are going to be in life. You have it all figured out. But then... Yeah. You know, things just
then
kind
life
of progress.
Comes along. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Life does that to you. And which is okay. I think that's one thing I worry about with my kids and all of their friends I know. They all seem to feel the need to be on a very specific path to a very specific future. Yeah. And you know, what I always try to tell my kids and other young folks around here is, you know, that's one thing that's wonderful about the University of Illinois is there are lots of paths to happy. And you're picturing a kind of happy right now, and whether you think you're going to be a dietitian or a social worker or a financier or a lawyer or whatever, that's great, but that's one path to one kind of happy. And if you change your mind, that's okay. And at a big university that's excellent in many areas like Illinois, you can find another happy and you don't have to leave. And that's nice because a lot of, you know, young people have to change universities when they change their major. And we really have a lot of good options for people.
So when as a student, I've stuck with journalism, which I love, but I didn't realize that my even the gen eds that I took at the classes that I thought like, oh, why do I have to take all of these like psychology classes or English? They've helped me grow more as a person than even you know, academically.
Well, and it's one thing. I mean, journalism is kind of a professional school. You know, you're learning how to write, how to use equipment, how to record, how to edit. You know, that sort of thing. If you don't know anything at all about the world, the stuff you write is going to be garbage. Right. And if you look at a lot of the stuff that's being written these days that counts for journalism, it's by people who have not been trained.
They don't have the
experience. Have not had a liberal education, and they don't understand those things. So, you know, when I came back and got a master's in journalism a few years out of school, and I took econ and poli sci and history and all those things that, you know, if I was covering, you know, a city's budget and I wasn't feeling like I understood it, I wanted to say, okay, you know, let me get some more micro, let me get some more, you know, this or that. And then I came back and got an MBA after that too. So I think having that kind of an education is really important for a journalist, and you can tell when they don't have it. So you took a good path.
Yeah. My parents are happy that I'm happy with it. They don't have to worry about it anymore. And your role now, having had so many different experiences at the university, you know, again, as a first generation student, as a former student yourself and a mom, how much of that do you put into your work? And like, you know, I imagine a lot of that you can use as your own fodder to help current students.
It does color everything you do. I think, you know, you see everything through your own lens. But one thing that's been fun in my job is because I get to meet students every semester, every year, whatever, and work with some of them, and because I get to see the university kind of evolve and grow and fall and get back up and that sort of thing, it does give you a really interesting perspective. And I'm now at the point where I'm feeling a little more like the farmer's insurance guy, right? You know, we know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two. It takes more and more for me to say, holy schmoly, what do we do there? You know, and I think that's a value to be able to say, yeah, we've done that, and let me pull my file on that one, or let me pull the file out of my head on that one, and be able to say, okay, let's see, here's what's similar about this situation, here's what's different, and what we know, and you can kind of, you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time, but we still have things happen that I just, you know, we have no roadmap for. I mean, the Ying Ying Zhang case, you know, what the heck was that, you know, and how you could have some evil person do something like that in this community in broad daylight is just horrifying to me, and I would never have said, you know, oh, you should be afraid, you know, on Goodwin Avenue at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Never. I used to give a lot of kids rides. You know, if it was raining, I always will pull over and say, hey, do you want to hop in? And now I don't do it anymore because I think I don't want to terrorize somebody and have them think, oh my gosh, I'm going to die. You know, just let them go on about their business. And that's sad. Because that guy, you know, really destroyed a part of our community and a part of, you know, our security and being here. But usually that's a pretty rare thing to have just some totally unheard of thing happen these days. So,
And with the Ying Ying story, from your perspective, how was that? You know, that got so much national attention, and not always in the best light of the university.
Yeah.
How was it to navigate that?
Well, so here's the thing about something like that. You can't really put your reputation at the forefront with something like that. You have to just do what you can to help that family. And that's really what we did, and we all made very clear from the start that that's how we were going to handle it. You know, if people wanted to think bad things about the university, think bad things about the university. You know, we know it's a very safe place. We know that was a very anomalous thing that happened, but we needed to be there and support that family first of all. But we have done things to, you know, our safety measures, our safety training was really all written for people from the United States, people from Illinois, you know, I don't know, did you watch Barney when you were a kid? What was the thing?
I did, yeah.
So, you know, don't cross the street in the middle of the road, you know, that kind of stuff, you know.
Something like Dora that explicitly told
exactly.
you what was
right
and what was
wrong. Yeah, and we write that stuff, and then we translate it into other languages if we're trying to be really, you know, helpful to new students who are from other countries. But if their cultural experience doesn't match ours at all, then, you know, they don't know anything except the, you know, the transliteration of what we've given them. And so, you know, if it's not dangerous in China to get in a car with a stranger, you've got to be really clear about that sort of thing. And, you know, but as you become a more international university, you've got to navigate all those kind of waters. And so we've been really trying hard to make sure that Chinese students are telling us, yeah, this is really helpful to me. Here's a gap. Could you fill that gap? We have an orientation session for Chinese students in China, and we're actually going to send a uniformed officer. You know, we've had student affairs people give the training, but we're going to send a uniformed officer over to answer specific questions from parents and students so we can hear exactly what their concerns are. So
I've always wondered that. So if you are an international student, you do get Some training beforehand?
That's a pretty new thing. We've only done it for a few years now, and it's only really in three places in China we go to, because that's obviously our largest international populations come from there. We can't afford to do it every single place we have students from, because, you know, we have students from 100 countries, but we do hit those cities, and we may have to start doing it in India too, because we have such a large population from India. But we try to do the best we can, and obviously we do a lot of orientation when they get here. But we're realizing that there's some things that we really ought to do before they get here. I don't know if you were here or remember, a few years ago we had a student, an Asian student, who was swindled at O'Hare Airport by someone who charged them thousands of dollars.
I wasn't here, but I do remember the story.
Yeah, very bad. So now we've figured out, hey, let's take a bunch of buses up and let's have bus service for kids, that where you can say, this is university supplying it. You know it's safe. You know it's kosher. It's all good. And we go from there. So we're just trying to learn those sorts of things and do better at that. And then I think the other big challenge we face is to get students from different backgrounds to respect each other, be kind to each other, listen to each other, and then share their stories as well. So, you know, we've got lots of students from different ethnicities and faiths and all sorts of things, and we want to make sure that everybody has a chance to listen and be heard.
And, you know, even this, within the past year, of course, it's campus has been in the world, in the nation, have been very politically divisive. There's been a lot of protests. The Ying Ying story and a lot of other things. Do you find that, from my perspective, and maybe it's just because I'm a student here now, but it seems like there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
Do you see that? Or, you know, has there always been stuff?
No, it's funny you mentioned that. I was doing some analysis of, you know, crisis communications is supposed to be a piece of my job. You know, I run the Office of Public Affairs. So we have, you know, we do news releases about faculty achievements. We do the university website. We create videos. We have a little in-house ad agency. We do a lot of things. We do all the FOIA responses. Crisis communications is supposed to be a piece of it. It has become consuming. And I was doing an analysis, and it is pretty clear that in normal times, we might have 5 to 6 things going on that you might see as a crisis. And crisis can be a good thing or a bad thing. You win 2 Nobel Prizes 2 days in a row, you go into the same mode. That's right. But usually I'm saying 5 to 6 probably unpleasant things. And maybe at a department level, a student level, could be campus level, whatever. Since January of this year, routinely, we've had between 20 and 28 going at any one time. And you can trace most of them back to the fact that it's, you know, there's this national kind of unrest, if you will, of people just really feeling frightened, threatened, angry, whatever. So that's it's been pretty blatant. Yeah. No, it's not just you. You're
that's
right. You're,
that's
yeah,
good
yeah,
to know.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how, like, you now, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounded like you kind of, you know what you're doing. Having done it for a couple of years, you're able to have those experiences. Do you remember a time when some of these crises or anything related was just like, oh, you seemed very overwhelming?
I wouldn't say it was ever overwhelming. And you know, I'm not the only person who deals with stuff. I'm one member of a pretty big team.
Staff.
Yeah, there's and a campus level team. So there's a group called the Campus Emergency Operations Committee, and it has the police and student affairs and the provost office and the chancellor and legal and public affairs and, you know, all these different groups together. So I'm one member of that. I'm the spokesman. So when we decide what we're doing, I'm the one who goes out and tells everybody. But I'm not the one making, you know, unilateral decisions or anything. But yeah, when I first started, I would think I knew what was right, and lots of times I'm kind of mouthy, if you hadn't noticed, and I would blah, 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 you know, vomit my ideas on everybody, and lots of times they would just ignore me and move along, and I thought, doggone it, you know, why are they not listening to me? And then I'd hear these other really thoughtful, you know, really carefully, you know, argued ideas, and I'd realize, oh, that was pretty stupid what I said. That was not helpful at all. And so I think, you know, you'd learn to kind of sit and listen and kind of eventually you get to the point where you know more. But I, when I got my MBA, which was, I don't know, 15 or 16 years ago, I had a teacher, his name's Greg Northcraft, and he was amazing. And he had a lesson one day early on in the semester. He was a social scientist who was in the College of Business. And he had this lesson where we came in and he gave everybody a stack of police reports. And he said, it was like a whodunit thing. He said, I want you all to read these police reports by yourself. Don't talk to anyone else. And in 15 minutes, I want you to tell me who you think committed this murder. And so you'd read through these reports. You had four or five reports. And you'd think, oh, I'm not completely sure. But I think maybe it was, you know, Mary or whatever. And then he'd say, you know, who all thinks it was Mary? And you'd raise your hand. And only a few other people raised their hand. And you'd think, oh, okay, those are the smart people in the class. And then he'd say, you know, who thinks Bill did it? And other people would raise their hands. And you'd think, you dummy, it clearly wasn't Bill. He's got an alibi. And then, you know, it had four or five, you know, potential suspects. And so then he said, okay, I want you to do the exercise again, only this time get yourself into groups and then talk about it. And so what do? You immediately go and you find the other people who thought Mary did it, right? Because they're clearly the smart ones in the room. So you all get together. And what happens is the Marys get together, the Bills get together, you know, whatever. And then there was this group of people who maybe weren't paying attention or walked in late or were shy or, you know, whatever, and they get together and they're just kind of tossed together, right? And so he gives us 15 more minutes and he says, okay, who thinks Mary did it? And the Mary group raises their hand. Who thinks Bill did it? You know, on and on and on. And then he says, anybody have any other ideas? And that last group of those kind of sad birds raises their hand and they say, oh no, it was George. And we go, George? What the heck is that? And he says, why did you think George did it? And they said, well, when we got together, we realized none of us had a whole set of reports. We all had a few different ones. And when we put them all together, yeah, we saw it was George. And then you realize, oh, my God, I only went with the people who had the exact same information as me and thought about it the exact same way I did. And you realize if people have different information from you, it's either or think differently from you, it's either because they have different information or they have life experiences that allow them to see that information differently. So you really have to try to get people together who think differently from you and who say, no, what you're doing is a dumb idea, and say, okay, wait, why do you think it's dumb? And tell me what your idea is and why do you believe that? And get to the bottom of that. And the truth is probably somewhere in the middle of all that stuff. And it's really hard to do. And I still struggle with it because when people think like me, I automatically think I am smart. Thus, they are smart. Thus, we should get together and bulldoze everyone else. But you really have to fight that because nobody's got a monopoly on the truth. And the way you're going to get as close to it as possible is by trying to get everything out on the table and analyze it all together and try to get to that shared goal.
That's a great story.
Yeah, he's a great teacher.
Yeah,
that's an Illinois teacher.
You caught my expression. I lit up once I realized.
It's kind of a goosebump moment. Yeah. When I was sitting in that class, that was that was one of the, I don't know, it was within the first couple of weeks when I started the program. And it, to this day, is probably the best lesson I ever had in my entire academic career at Illinois. It was pretty amazing. Yeah.
And to end, in addition to that great story, which might be the answer to this, do you have any advice for current students that you would parlay?
Yeah. So use the resources we have. I try to get my own kids to do it. You know, the Career Center, for example. The thing that makes them the saddest is when people are 3 weeks from graduating and they go in and they say, can you help me with a resume? And they say, you know, we really want people to come in as freshmen and we can show them the blank piece of paper and we can show them what a solid resume looks like and say, what activities do you want to be in? What leadership roles do you think you want to develop? What kind of courses do you want to take so that when you get 4 years from now, you can fill this resume in and say, that's what I've done. So we have a lot of really good resources here, but kids can be really shy about using them. And I know, again, with my own kids, and I shouldn't be outing them like this in public because that's really rude, but I will anyway because I'm their mom and I can do it, right? Yeah, that's what we do. But for example, they both lived in Weston Hall and you know, it was the Explorations Living Learning Community, and they didn't take advantage of a lot of those opportunities. They would have had to go and really think about what do I want to do, and both of them ended up changing majors a couple of times. And they might have been able to not have to go through that struggle if they had taken the time at the beginning to figure out, okay, let me go ask them these questions. But, you know, you get here and you don't want to be goofy. You want to look cool. You don't want to look like you don't know anything. You just want to hang out with friends. You don't want to be in any organized stuff that seems high schoolish. But that stuff is there for a reason, and it really can help you. And the kids who access that really do better. And also, we have an awesome library. Use it. You know, it is the largest public university library in North America, sometimes in the world, you know, depends on the year, and it's fantastic. And it was really created very carefully by people 150 years ago, specifically, so we would be a world-class university today. And it is such a great resource. And whether it means checking out an old book that's got paper in it, or whether it means going and talking to a librarian and having them help you learn to research, being at a research university, learning those research skills, those analytical skills, huge. And that's really what sets you apart when you go to get a job and you say, I went to the University of Illinois, and you've got some little thing, you know, where you've done some research, maybe you worked in somebody's lab or something like that, or you've helped a professor, you know, with whatever. It means something to employers. It shows that you know how to think. You know how to think critically and analytically, and that's a big thing. That's our specialty.
Do you have a favorite library on campus? We have so many.
Yeah, we do have so many. I noticed, yeah, my younger daughter uses Granger all the time, which obviously wasn't there when I was in school. You know, I love the main library. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. But, you know, to get down in the undergrad library and just, you know, sit in a carrel, an old, you know, kind of worn out carrel, that's the best. I just love it. Or, you know, just to read anywhere on campus. You know, the whole campus is kind of a library, really. But they're all good. Yeah, the basement of the communications library, I spent a lot of time there.
Same here.
I should say media library. Pardon me. I was in the College of Communications, so yeah, it's a lot of stuff changed. But yeah, it's, you know, there's just not a bad one. There's not a dog in the bunch. They're all really good. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That was fun.
So that's our conversation with Robin Kaler. If you liked or didn't like what you heard, don't hesitate to give us a review or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Google Play. A few thanks are in order before we head out. Thanks to Robin, thanks to our audio editor, Aaron Navarro, and as always, thanks to you for tuning in. This is To The Orange. We'll catch you next episode, and have a good one.